Welcome back to Pace Immigration, paceimmigration.com, talking with immigration lawyers Michael O'Rourke and Andy Semichuk. Good to see you guys.
Hello. Happy New Year.
Thank you. We've got, we get messages all the time on LinkedIn, Twitter, the various channels, through the emails on how do I move to Florida? And what we're going to cover today really applies, I guess, to the entire United States because immigration is a federal issue in the United States. But we do get a lot of requests on how do I move to Florida for whatever reason, whether it's the climate, the way of life, whatever it is down there that's attracting people. So I thought we should go through all the myriad ways that someone might be able to move to Florida. The first one we'll start with is probably the most basic. And Michael, if you want to take this one on, the B2 visitor visa. Go ahead.
Sure. So in general, Canadians don't need visas for most things. And if you're a Canadian citizen, you can just apply at the border and ask for entry into the United States for up to 6 months. You cannot work on a B2 visa. This is just for tourism purposes. So, you know, enjoy the beaches, have good Cuban food, but you can't work.
Right. There's no working there. And the stay is up to 6 months. And they mean that, don't they?
Yes. So you can exceed the 6 months, but 6 months is the maximum. When you come to the border, the CBP officer will issue you a period of stay that can be up to 6 months, but it might be a month. So we always tell our clients to check their I-94 record online to make sure that you can stay as long as you think you can stay.
Okay. Moving right along, we've got the TN visa. Andy, if you want to cover some the TN visa, which this time you can work.
Yes. This is probably the fastest and easiest way to go down to the United States, to Florida in our case here, and work. It's really great for professionals. There's a list of the ones that can work, and I think you've got a slide on that. Yeah, there you go. So those are some of the people that are on the list. And all basically you need is a letter showing that you're going to be working for someone, for example, as a hotel manager. That seems to be one that I have overlooked in the past, but it's a great one for anybody who's in that field. And we can help get someone in like overnight, like if someone needs to overnight come into the United States from Canada. From Mexico, it takes a little longer, and you have to be a citizen of either Canada or Mexico. And, you know, the great part of it is how quickly it can be done either way.
Right, Michael, basically what you're looking at, I noticed when I was reading through it again, one is you need that job offer, but also you need, it's basically they're looking at bachelor degree and up, is that right?
Generally, there are a couple fields where you don't need a bachelor's degree, such as engineering technician or technologist or a scientific technician, technologist, or a management consultant. Those are special cases, and they require more proof than, say, your average nurse or lawyer or engineer coming down. But in general, bachelor's degree. They also want to see that you've worked in the field. If, say, I have a JD in law, but I haven't actually worked as a lawyer, then I might get more questions from the border guards. So, of course, before you do anything, come and talk to us just so that you're ready to go and put your sandals on when you get to Florida.
Right. We've got
important to note, you have to be a citizen of either Canada or the United States.
Right. I've got some particulars here. If you're listening on the podcast, you can slip on over to our YouTube channel to take a look at the slides as well. We've got here not available for Canadian permanent residents. So we are looking at citizenship is important. I just wanted to touch on this list really quickly. We've got about a dozen here, including architect, accountant, dietitian, registered nurse, physical therapist. But Michael, this list is actually quite big, isn't it?
Yeah, there are 63 or 64 different professions that you can work in and use the TN visa to come into the United States. Unfortunately, most business type of professions, say like a general manager or I don't know, payroll specialist or HR, those are not on the list.
Right.
But sometimes we can figure out ways to get around that.
Right. Andy, I wanted to touch on one last thing because we get this question a lot too. Unfortunately, the people that are in like skilled trades, they don't end up on this list, do they?
No, they don't. I also want to mention chiropractors are not on the list. That's another occupation that seems should be, but is not. Right. So we have to find other options for those type of people. Okay. And there are other options we're going to be coming to.
Right. And I suggest people visit the United States Customs and Immigration Service website, and they can take a look at the entire list and see if they fall on it. We've got the L1. Andy, would you like to touch on this?
Yeah. Traditionally, or just think of this example, Toyota has a manager in Tokyo, and they're transferring that manager, let's say, to Florida, to Miami, to work on their Toyota facilities there. That's a classic intercorporate transferee L1 visa for managers, executives, or specialized workers. And they're great. This is another one that's super for Canadians because you can get this thing right at the border without going through the consulates. Although the consulates are, I noticed recently they've, the USCIS has, or the, I guess the State Department has indicated that they can waive interviews with respect to certain people who are L1 applicants and a few other visas. So that could speed things up in terms of getting the visa through a consulate. In Canada, you don't need a consulate visa to get in on an L1. So that's why it's so great for Canadians.
Right. I mean, some of the stuff that we're dealing with here is actually people need to kind of massage their life to make it fit, right? Like, obviously, the L1 is dependent upon the company wanting to send you there, but there's nothing wrong with maybe going by the boss's office and mentioning that you're interested.
Right. Also, it's great for startups. You can start up, if you've got a good company abroad, say in Canada or Mexico or wherever, and you want to start up a new company as a subsidiary in the United States, you can use the L1 as a way of doing that.
Excellent. Okay. Carrying right along to the E1 treaty trader visa. And Michael, before we came on the air, you corrected me on something, which I think is actually kind of exciting. I've got some logos on the slide, if you're watching on the YouTube channel, which show the big airplane, the shipping containers, the big trucks. The E1 treaty trader visa for a company which engages in substantial trade in goods or services with the U.S., but that's malleable, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So you don't have to have a Boeing 777 to take advantage of this visa. As long as you have a company that is engaging in trade with U.S. and has U.S. customers, and the trade with the U.S. is more than with any other country, you can apply to be an E1 treaty trader. So say if you have a boutique soap business, soap making business, and most of your sales abroad are to the US or to US customers, and it's substantial, and that's the where the devil is in the details, because substantial can mean different things for different types of businesses. But if you have substantial trade, substantial sales to the U.S. of either goods or services, you can request to be considered an E1 treaty trader. You don't have to set up a U.S. company. And although you do have to get a visa at a U.S. consulate, which can take some time, especially these days, it's a great way to install yourself in the U.S. through your trade with your foreign company.
Excellent. So basically, if you're doing a lot of trade with the U.S., there's a good chance you could fall into the E1.
Yes.
Excellent. All right. And we've also got the E2 treaty trader visa. And Andy, this one seems much more about money than it does necessarily about goods. Am I right on that?
It is. Yeah, you're right, Sean. This is a classic. You know, I'm buying a hotel in the United States. How do I get in to run it? E2 visa. Gas station, same thing. I might point out, in reference to several of these slides, the employment-based slides we were going through, usually you're involving someone who's petitioning you from Florida. So they are Florida-specific in regard to people who are interested in going to Florida. So, you know, it's not just general in that respect. But anyway, the E2 is, you know, I'm purchasing a business. I want to go in and run it. How do I do it? You can be either a manager or executive of a business as well, but Classically, it's an investor who's buying a business and going in to run it.
Ballpark figure on that? Like, what kind of business are we talking about? Is a hot dog stand all the way up to a hotel, or does that be a certain amount?
Can be. I use just for my own purposes, like a working rule. It's not the law. It's just my own working rule. I'm looking for a minimum 100,000 U.S. investment to make things, you know, it can be done for less, but, you know, you're skating on thin ice. I prefer to see a little bit of cash involved. And it all depends on the nature and size of the business. You know, for a hot dog stand, 100,000 is perfect. But for, you know, like, I don't know, a real estate business, for example, every house you look at in Toronto, for example, is worth $1 million. If you're coming into the consulate and saying you want to do real estate development, 100,000 may not cut it. You know, I mean, you may have to invest substantially more. Depends right. On the business.
Right. Michael, anything on the E2?
The only thing I would add is that the business can't be marginal. And that means that it has to make more money than just paying your salary. Okay. So say you invest $75,000 in a mall kiosk business where you're going to sell the soap that I made in my E1 company. If you're going to do that and you'll say only make $50,000 a year and that's your projected sales for the next 5 years, they're going to look at that and say, what are you going to add to the economy except for paying for your own salary? So the business has to have some sort of trajectory and has to be able to support more than just yourself.
Yeah. Andy, is there a job addition requirement? I know that there are some visas in various countries where they say you need to add 2 jobs or 10 jobs and hire 10 people. Is there anything like that with the E2?
There's not a requirement, but there's only 3 reasons why the United States would approve an E2 visa. One is a substantial amount of money coming in. And by substantial, I mean like more than, let's say, $1 million, like a lot of money. Number 2 is you're bringing in some kind of critical know-how. Think like Sergey Brin brought in Google to the United States. And number 3 is employment. So if you're not bringing in a lot of money and you're not bring in some kind of new innovation, then you're down to employment, which means over the course of 5 years, which is usually how much you get initially, you should be, you know, creating some jobs, 2-3 jobs at least.
Okay. In other words, it can't hurt. If you're saying, look, I'm going to employ 10 Americans, that sounds good.
Yeah, it sure does.
Okay. Let's move on to our next one, which is the H-1B. Michael, I'm sorry to throw this hand grenade at you. This legal hand grenade. The H-1B, let's face it, is going through some turmoil right now. But if you'd like to field that for people that think the H-1B might be the way to go for them to live in the United States or Florida specifically.
Sure. So the H-1B is everybody's favorite punching bag. But for short-term moves to Florida, it's not going to work. Probably will not work in your circumstances, just because of the timing. So in general, if you're working in a non-cap exempt organization, basically any organization other than a research facility tied to a university, hospital, things like that, you're going to have the company first enter a lottery through registration. If the registration is chosen, then you make the application. If the application is approved, then finally you're able to work. And this looks over a 6-month time span from about March, and you're finally work authorized by October. So it's difficult. In addition, you have to have a bachelor's degree or at least equivalent experience or better. You have to be in certain specialty occupations, which is a term of art, which is defined as something that requires some sort of legal and theoretical foundation of applying I'm actually screwing this way up, but it is.
If you can screw it up, I'm sure we can screw it up.
Yeah, I mean, no, but what they want with a specialty occupation is that you have learned something and that you are applying it in the field. Right. So just to take all the legal jargon out of it. But H-1B is a tough sell these days, just because so many people don't even get through the registration process, even if they would otherwise qualify for the visa. But if you go to the next slide, Sean, there are some variants that can work a little bit better, but you have to have the right citizenships. So E3s for Australians, H1B1 for Singaporean and Chileans. If you have any of those nationalities, there's a streamlined process that's kind of within the H1B ambit, but it's easier to get in and easier to get work authorization, generally only requiring an appointment at a consulate.
Right. I mean, you know, the H1B right now is going through some, well, it's not going through some changes, but it could be, and that's when we can come back to the H-1B. But we certainly wouldn't, you're not recommending the H-1B as what people should hang their hat on.
No, of course, when a client comes to us and presents facts, they have a job offer in the U.S. especially, then we look at all of the options and see what makes sense. But often H-1B is something that has to be planned out well in advance.
Okay.
Visa of last resort, so to speak.
Gotcha. And if people want to visit the YouTube channel, if they're not already on it, you can take a look at the slides and hit pause and go through the various things that are on there, the criteria for the H-1B. We'll move on to our next one, which is the H-2A. Michael, if you want to carry on with the H's, you can do the H-2A, which is for the workers in the temporary or seasonal agricultural occupation.
Sure. So for H-2A, it's a similar type of thing where the company has to go through a series of processes first in order to extend the job offer so that you can ultimately get a visa at a U.S. consulate. You can come into the U.S. for a year and renew it for up to a period maximum of 2 years. It is, again, not one that you can do on your own. And a company usually has to go through quite an extensive process beforehand. Plus, the number of H2s are capped. So, again, this is something usually that an employer would approach us for, along with the H2B, which Andy's going to speak to next. It's just something that is a possibility, but it's not a typical route that people use to come into the U.S. and come to Florida.
Right. And if you want to touch on the H-2B, which is kind of the classic, someone working at a ski resort for the winter, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly right. For the first one, the agricultural, probably oranges in Florida might be an area where they might employ H-2A workers. H-2B, as you mentioned, ski resorts, restaurants, peak season, sort of Adirondack, you know, hotels and restaurants are a classic example where they need cooks or, you know, waitresses and stuff like that during peak season. Same thing would be probably true in Florida, perhaps during the peak tourist seasons. Same kind of a deal. This is a labor certification effort that the employer would have to undertake first and then bring the workers in. These are not for your average Joe, but it's employer driven. You got to have an employer that really wants these workers to go down these routes.
Okay, we'll carry on with the next one on our menu, which is the O-1 for individuals of extraordinary ability. Andy, you've written on this before in your Forbes column. Take it away.
Okay, so in my column, I mentioned Drake, the singer. That would be a typical O-1 type of guy, someone with extraordinary talent in some area. I had a guy who worked for AOL and raised a lot of money, like millions of dollars for AOL, and he got an O-1 for doing that. That's the kind. It's a celebrity visa, but it's excellent if you stand out in your occupation or profession. And it goes all around. But I'll give you an example of how it doesn't work. I had an example of a guy who was a psychiatrist and very educated and taught at universities and, you know, the whole works. But we just couldn't get him over the line because there are a lot of doctors and, you know, the medical profession is full of people with, two pages worth of publications and stuff like that. You got to do a lot of documenting. So it depends on the area. And, you know, Wayne Gretzky, the old hockey player, would be an 0-1 type extraordinary ability.
Right.
But it depends on the individual.
Michael, I noticed that artists can fall under this too. And it's interesting you mentioned that you've had success with architects.
Yes. So it requires extraordinary ability in arts, business, or the sciences. And architects, for some reason early in my career, I had a lot of architect clients who, because each building is unique, or often they are, and at least we can make the argument that they're unique. Sure. And architects they tick off a number of the extraordinary ability criteria, such as publications about them, publications about their work, if their work is judged. All of these things go into making an extraordinary ability case. And sometimes USCIS will push back in different professions, like Andy mentioned with the psychiatrist, because they're already working at such a high level that what they do might be similar to what everybody else does in their field. But if you can stand out, if people are writing about you, if there's a buzz about your career, or if you're making a ton of money, that's another one of the criteria. If we can package those, then an 0-1 for somebody who is actually extraordinary is often a good fit and a good way to go to the U.S. Plus, you not only get a work visa for 3 years, it's renewable pretty much forever, as long as you're extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. When you mentioned the money there, I was like, of course they're going to let you in because then they can tax it.
Right? Well, so yeah.
If you're making a lot of money, it's in their benefit too, right?
That's moving from the legal to the business side. You're commenting on business matters.
Yeah, I mean, I don't blame them, right? If you're making a boatload of money, the government's like, you know, we can have some of that.
Okay. Government's like money.
Yes. One thing I did want to point out on this one as well, because I've had people talk to me about it before, and they seem to think the 0-1 is you're kind of self-petitioning, getting yourself, you still need that job, don't you?
Yeah. So in the U.S. system, there's the temporary and then there's the permanent. So 0-1 is a temporary non-immigrant visa. Even if you get it for 3 years and you renew it 10 times and you're there for 30 years, well, maybe then they'll start looking at it. But that's on the temporary side. Almost every temporary work visa needs an employer sponsor. Right. On the permanent side, there is one way for somebody of extraordinary ability to self-petition for a green card. But that it, not only do you have to meet all of the 0-1 criteria of extraordinary ability, it's an uphill battle. One of my first cases was one of those, and through multiple requests for evidence, we finally got the government to agree that yes, my client was extraordinary, and they granted the green card. But she was well renowned in her field and had worked all over the world, PhD plus. So it's not typical.
Not typical, right? Yeah. The P1, Andy, for the sports people.
Yes. I have a client right now, as a matter of fact, a golfer, a lady golfer, who's applying for a P1 with her coach and with her caddies, who are supplemental figures in the P1 scenario. So all three should be able to get through. They got through before, so I'm confident they'll get through again. And the key thing here is you have to have a no objection letter from a union or a guild of some kind. In the case of these athletes, the LPGA is the letter right. that you have to get. It's kind of a sine qua non, as they say in Latin. Without it, you're going nowhere, but with it, you can get the P1 visa.
Okay. And based, so the P1 is kind of like the O1, but to, you know, mainly for sports.
Athletes. For athletes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Carrying on to the next one, we have the R1, which is for, we threw this one in here, religious workers and clergy. I tend to think that that is almost, it comes from above, as it were, that they get sent to these various places and then you take care of the R1. But I'm assuming that someone, I don't know, maybe Michael, if you've had in your experience, you've done some R1s.
Actually, my last R1 case took a teaching job at a religious run or a school run by a religious denomination. She was of the same denomination, and she was able to come into the U.S. as an R1 because she was teaching not your traditional math, English, whatever, but teaching within the religion's tenets. So right. I don't want to give away too much because I don't want to discuss her particular situation, but it is possible, and it's used more than you'd think, actually. Okay. So, and it covers more than just the clergy. Religious workers of all sorts can use the R1.
Right. Andy, I remember years ago, I mentioned someone to you and they were having a problem. They wanted to know about getting, and you just kind of shrugged and went, yeah, R1. And you took care of it. I mean, it was pretty straightforward for you.
Yeah. Imams, rabbis, priests, pastors, and all their, you know, like the monks, the nuns and all that, that's all R1.
Right.
And there's another little trick that you can add, which is if it's a seminary, like Michael was commenting on someone who's almost in the seminary kind of a thing, mm-hmm. you can get a TN for a seminary if you're teaching in a seminary as well.
If I might add, though, the person who is applying for the R1 visa has to be a recognized member of a denomination. Yeah. So it has to be an organized religion, and they have to have a track record, and they actually have to get somebody, an authority figure from the denomination to write a letter to attest that they are actually a practicing member of that denomination.
Again, we go back to it. If it's in the temporary, then there's an employer somewhere. There's some.
Usually, you'll go, for example, in Catholic, in the Catholic faith, you'll go to a bishop to write a letter, sort of someone high up saying, yeah, this person is one of us. Bring them in.
I got you. Okay.
One thing, if I could add before we leave our one, it comes and goes, but it has been reauthorized now by Congress. There is a fairly easy path to permanent residence for somebody with an R1 visa. If you've been in the U.S. in an R1 for 2 years, I believe, you can then, with the backing of your denomination, apply for a green card under EB4. And it's a great way to go if you check off all the boxes.
Excellent. Okay. Family sponsorship. I saved this for last, even though maybe it's probably top of the list in terms of if you get married to an American or you have a parent that's an American, it kind of speeds the path, doesn't it, Michael?
Yes. Start dating. If you haven't married an American already, there are different ways that it can happen. Marriage to a U.S. citizen spouse is one way. If one of your parents is an American citizen, then you might also be an American citizen. It's not necessarily automatic, and it depends on how long your parent was in the United States and when they were in the United States. But we can definitely look at that and figure it out. Another thing to add, with the good, there is the bad, and sometimes relationships end, and there are different routes for spouses where, say that there's been abuse and neglect in the relationship. There's the Violence Against Women Act, which allows a battered spouse, and it doesn't have to be, it can be any gender spouse, doesn't have to be a woman, even though it's the Violence Against Women Act. But if a person has been married to a U.S. citizen and they encounter violence and the relationship ends, they can still sometimes adjust to being a permanent resident Of course, this is heavily fact specific, but there is a route there. You're not completely foreclosed from your Florida dream and staying in the U.S.
And that's good to know. If someone's in that situation, that they can find help that way, though.
So let me just add something else to this particular category. I'm a sure. big believer in this online dating and meeting scenario. And a lot of the spouses that come through our office are people who met online. And the reason why that's working is because they get their values sorted out first, and then the chemistry clicks in, as opposed to the other way, where the chemistry is first and the values go out the window. So you have to prove a genuine marriage. And for those who might have some questions about that or wondering about that, the film The Proposal, starring Sandra Bullock, is a yes. good film to watch. You'll see there what you have to meet in terms of you know, what could be asked about you and how they might deal with you on this subject.
Yeah, I mean, they can ask for old letters or emails or things that can prove it. They'll ask you, like, what kind of toothpaste does he use? These kind of things, right?
I had an opera singer in California who was in a sort of a very iffy kind of relationship. And they had the USCIS officers coming in at 2 o'clock in the morning, knocking on their door and asking, well, where is he? To the, you know, the woman answering the door. And he wasn't there. So then they were going through her closets. Where are his clothes? Where are your clothes? I mean, it's surreal, you know, this business of how you have to prove that it's a legitimate relationship. But luckily they got through.
Right. I mean, Michael, what the American government looking, the U.S. government's looking for marriages of convenience. Is that it?
Right. They want to make sure that there's no marriage fraud. So keep everything. Keep cards. Keep photos, take lots of photos, keep your texts. You never know when you might need to blackmail your spouse too. So,
but you lawyers.
Yeah, well, you know, we have criminal lawyers if you need a referral. But keep everything, because you are going to need to prove, if you go down the marriage route, that this relationship is real. And sometimes I've had cases where we had some rather colorful evidence that we had to submit because there wasn't anything else, but it worked.
Oh my. Yeah, we won't go down that road too far, but I get what you mean. So you had to look through the love letters, basically. It's what we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. To sum up, gentlemen, what I'm hearing from this as we wrap this up, out of all of those collection, that alphabet soup of US immigration, of the different visas, obviously, Mexicans and Canadians have a leg up on that TN. I think that TN sounds like a fantastic way to go in terms of getting the job offer, and the visa can almost happen instantaneously, can't it?
Yes, for Canadians. For Mexicans, unfortunately, you have to go through a U.S. consular interview. You can't do it just at the border, but even then...
It's pretty good for Mexicans, too, though. I've done Mexicans. It's not that bad.
No, it is definitely a streamlined approach to getting work authorization in the U.S.
Excellent.
And I just want to add, Sean, there are other ways. These are the main ways. But, you know, come to us if you have a weird set of facts. Maybe we can figure out a way for you to get down there.
Andy, what I've seen you do this before with people, like you tend to lean towards the E2 if they have nothing else, but they do have some money and maybe an idea or a business or something that can really work, can't it?
Yeah, there are challenges. You know, we're just skating over the superficial parts of this. You know, sure. There are challenges with every visa. It's not. It's a difficult area to work with. For example, just because you got money doesn't mean you're going to get a visa.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you're buying something in the United States, I mean, there's a good chance you will get the visa. But it's one of these things where, look, I can fly a 747 if I sit down at the control in the pilot's chair, pull out the manual at page one and spend, you know, the next 3 years reading the manual. Maybe eventually I can turn on the plane and maybe I can fly it. But the question is, do I have 3 years and do I want to do that just to fly from here to, Vancouver? No, I'll just pay a pilot I'll pay the airline to fly me. It's the same thing here with these immigration applications.
Yeah.
You need a professional to help you out, usually.
Well, between the two of you, you've done hundreds of them. I mean, people would be wise to look you up if they're thinking about going down this road. So there we are. We've covered them as briefly as we could. It took a little while, but of course it did because there's a lot of options there. But I appreciate you guys coming on to talk about it. That's Andy Semichuk and Michael O'Rourke. You can find them at paceimmigration.com, and they'll be sure to pick up the phone and help you out. Thank you, gentlemen.